Hello and welcome to episode 3 of season 2 of The Coriolis Effect, The Forbidden Emissary. I'm Dave.
And I'm Matthew, and boy, have we got a lot to talk about this episode.
We do.
We've been away for a month. Well, we haven't really. Obviously, we've been doing RPG a day throughout August, but that does mean that we haven't kind of been doing our usual content, so we've got really quite a lot to catch up on. We've got the release of the final PDFs for Forbidden Lands and the beta PDF for Emissary Lost, so we'll want to be talking about that. And on that theme, some listeners may also have heard Red Moon Roleplaying doing their actual play of A Song for Jeruma, which is a sort of prequel episode to the Emissary Lost campaign. We talked with Adam Palmquist, who is a writer on Emissary Lost and also the GM for Red Moon Roleplaying's brand new Emissary Lost Actual Play podcast. We've also got a bit of work I asked you to do last time we met, which seems a long time ago. And I asked you to explain poisons and explosions to me, so you've got that. And I think we've got quite a lot of catch up in our two Coriolis campaigns, haven't we?
We have a bit to talk about.
And then I'm going to talk about Al Mukadir, which is a ship I've designed for the crew in my Coriolis campaign. In fact, actually, as we'll find out, there are two ships involved.
Interesting. Look forward to seeing that. Cool. So we've got a bumper episode this month. So, well, let's go straight on into the world of gaming. I think the first thing I wanted to say was just very briefly reflect on how much I enjoyed doing the RPG A Day podcasts, and I hope our listeners enjoyed it and could cope with only hearing us for 5 or 6 minutes a day, even though it was every day for the month. But that was really good. I really, really enjoyed that, and I think we ought to try and do something similar next year.
Yeah, maybe something similar but different next year, hey? We don't want to be the same every time, do we? But yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was great fun recording them and talking about all sorts of things under the sun as prompted by the questions. But I hope, as you say, Dave, that our listeners have enjoyed it. I think we probably on average got about 50 or 60 more subscribers, and they're still being downloaded, so people are still listening, even though it is no longer the month of August.
Excellent.
So that's great to hear. It is. And if there are any more listeners for whom this is the first time you've heard our usual content, well, thank you for staying with us.
And welcome.
And prepare to be blown away.
Prepare to be blown away with just minutes upon minutes and hours upon hours of us blathering on about stuff.
But structured blathering on.
Barely.
And it will be longer than your 5 minute episodes.
It certainly will.
And in fact, actually, we can't make it too long. We have got a lot to talk about.
Yeah. So
Dave, tell me about Forbidden Lands.
Well, you should tell me about Forbidden Lands, because you've been doing your blogs on each chapter as you've been going through them, which I found really interesting. I have read all the books now, and I really am really excited to give this a go. I just read the other day your piece on rolling up random characters, which I thought was really interesting. And I think when it comes to rolling up a character, I'm going to reserve the right to choose, but I'm going to try doing it all with the rolls, because I think I quite like that idea. And games now, I think we talked about this before, a lot of games now, encourage you or push you down the direction of designing your character through your own preferences, rather than giving you a character that is much more random, and then you take that character and make of it what you can. And I quite like that randomness. So I'm looking forward to very much rolling up a character that I probably will absolutely hate, because I'll get all the wrong dice rolls from what I'm thinking of.
Well, we'll see. I mean, it's really interesting, actually, having done the process. We ought to explain, you've read all the books all the way through. I haven't yet. So you know a lot more about what's in the Game Master's Guide than I do, because literally I've started reading the first chapter of that. But what I'm doing is...
I was going to say, now, there is quite a lot of... reference material in the Game Master's book, as you'd expect, rather than additional rulings and stuff. I mean, the other thing that I really like about the game, and I'm really interested and keen to try, is the whole stronghold mechanic and element, which I think is something that, certainly for me, is a real strong point, real attraction for the game. I've played, I've GM'd Mutant Year Zero, where you have the Ark concept, which again, I really like that sort of additional level, additional layer of game over and above just the being your character. And then obviously the Stronghold takes that and does it differently. But again, it keeps that whole sort of home building warmth that I like in a game where you've got something to construct more than just accumulating gold, which I think is a really, really nice element. Looking forward to that big time. And we are hopefully going to be having a run of this in a week or two, aren't we? You're going to run a kind of one-off session for us.
Yeah, I hope I've read enough of the Game Master's Guide before then to be able to do it on it. I did try running a beta version, or the alpha version, actually, when that first came out, and I made a bit of a hash of it because it's somewhat more complex than Coriolis, actually. You think it's the same rule system, but actually there's more to think about and to keep track of. So it wasn't my best GMing session. But I'm really looking forward to trialing this guys with the team, and we may record it. The studio conditions where we're rolling aren't optimal, so we may decide it's not good enough, particularly if it rains.
No,
but if we do record it, we'll put it online as well.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about that. So I was thinking about that, and that would end up probably being called, you know, if you follow the same Simba Room effect. Principle that would be called the Forbidden Effect, potentially. And I was thinking, I was out for a long walk this morning and I was thinking about it and I thought, that rather sounds like the title of some crappy 1970s porn movie. So I might want to think of something else, maybe, but you never know.
You know, I've been mulling over things, and actually Forbidden comes up quite a lot, but pretty much everything sounds like a 1970s porn movie when you've got the word forbidden in. I thought about In Forbidden Company.
No, so, absolutely, because we're not Forbidden Company. We're Mandatory Company for our listeners, I hope.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe we should go with something about Ravenland or something like that instead. but we will keep people informed about that.
Yeah, the other thing that obviously I'm really looking forward to is just getting my hands on the books. And as this Kickstarter for Forbidden Lands is coming to its close, we should be getting them hopefully end of this month, early next. So I really cannot wait to get hold of those. That's going to be great. But talking of Kickstarters, I saw the other day that there is a Kickstarter starting in about a week or so, 18th of September, I think, for The Things from the Flood. Free Elegan's next installment in, I'm guessing, Mutant Year Zero Engine games, which takes the Tales from the Loop and gives it some teeth. In that you can... the kids have grown up a little bit and it's okay to kill them now. So
Does it actually say... It talks about it being darker than Tales from the Loop. Does it actually say you can die?
Yes.
In any of the pre-press
One of the things I saw on Facebook, one of the Free League guys had said, yes, the kids can die. So...
Right. Okay, that's all you need, Dave, isn't it? Because you've been desperate to kill those kids.
Well, I was, but I mean, as having played Tales from the Loop that one time, and hopefully I'll run the next of the scenarios that came with the core book when we meet up in early November. I loved it. It was great. I was convinced that you didn't need to have the threat of death to make a game play brilliantly well, which you did. But it was interesting. Looking at the cover art, I just had a sense of The Things from the Flood. I just had a real sense, is this Tales from the Loop meets Cthulhu? Are they stepping into that space a bit?
Strange tentacle creature.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It looked very Cthulhoid to me. And then I thought, is this also stepping on the toes or encroaching on the ground that is occupied by a cult? As well, certainly in the Swedish gaming community. Now, it made me also think, I'd quite like to get hold of Cult and just have a look at it, even if we don't get a chance to play it. but I'm quite excited about Things from the Flood. I fully expect I will back it. Although having said that, I've got a lot of stuff backed at the moment, and I probably have to draw the line somewhere, but probably not with Things from the Flood. I expect I'll back that.
Yeah, you went on Rain after we talked about it.
I did.
During RPG A Day, didn't you? So well done there. You know, I almost relented. There was a moment on a particular evening where I thought, actually, I'll get Rain as well, because obviously Dave's going to back it. And I went to the thing, and the Kickstarter had finished. And
oh, no.
I kind of felt relieved that okay. I didn't have to.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah.
They're producing more games, or they're kickstarting for more games, and you might think, well, surely they've got to start delivering on some of these. But as you've said, the hard copies of Forbidden Lands should be coming through our door, our letterboxes quite soon. And we've got the beta of Emissary Lost.
We have.
Now, you are under strict instructions not to download that PDF or read page one.
I've downloaded it.
You've downloaded it?
Yeah, I haven't read any of it, though.
Don't tell me you've downloaded it.
Well, if I hadn't downloaded it, I'd have lost the email somewhere in the depths of it, and I'd have never got around to downloading it at all. So I've downloaded it. I haven't read it. I thought it was very interesting when I texted you saying, oh, I'll just read the introduction. And you texted back, going, no, don't do it. No.
Don't read the introduction.
So
the introduction has major spoilers, guys.
Yeah.
If you are hoping to play this game,
don't read it.
Do not read even the introduction. Mm. I wonder, in fact, because this is a beta, I wonder whether Fear Le Gan will have learned from this and will put a new page one with a new introduction for players saying, go no further.
Yeah, yeah.
Read no more of this.
That's probably very wise. Yeah.
But I haven't actually had time to read it, partly because I work for a living and I'm doing a PhD and I was running a game last night and I'm reading very slowly Forbidden Lands and writing about it as I read.
Excuses, so, excuses. That's all you are, Matt, isn't it? Just one excuse after the other.
But as I say, two things have happened. One is I read the introduction and it blew my little mind.
See, it doesn't help me not reading it when you say things like that. You know.
And the other thing that happened is I thought, you know, this is going to have serious resonance and interaction with my campaign. And I had it loaded on my pad just in case an opportunity came up to do a quick search and find. And indeed, it was useful. It provided me with a non-player character for an action the guys took, and I thought rather than randomly roll one up, I'll see if this book's got one. And
okay,
it's already given me that, so that's brilliant. I've seeded the future Emissary Lost campaign in the campaign I'm running, which is always going to segue into Emissary Lost. That segue is going to be a bit more difficult, but also a bit more brilliant than it was going to be, I think, because it's marvellous. The little I've read of it so far is absolutely marvellous. Don't read it.
Thanks. I'm just wondering if I could read it and then just pretend I haven't.
Yes.
But then I
can't. We didn't get any clues.
I can't talk to you about it.
Did we? When we talked to Adam about it.
No.
He was very good at keeping us spoiler free.
He was, but we didn't spot any obvious spoilers in there, but maybe our audience might find them when they listen to us talking to Adam Palmquist.
So Dave and I are with Adam Palmquist, who is has got a long history with Coriolis, but you're here today, Adam, to talk particularly about the actual play podcast that you'll be GMing for our friends over at Red Moon.
Yeah.
But we're also interested to hear that you've been a writer on
Emissary Lost.
Thank you. Emissary Lost. And before that, on first edition Coriolis. So we ask all our interviewees the same question to start. Can you tell us all about your life in gaming?
Okay. Where should I start? I started playing tabletop RPGs when I was around 10 or 11 years old. I was invited by my neighbors to play with my best friend's big older brother, and we played a session of Drakar och Demoner. It's the Swedish version of Dungeons and Dragons, more or less, but with a slight different rule system. It's more of a basic role-playing system than the Dungeons and Dragons system. Ever since I've been more or less very into tabletop RPGs. But I work as a gamification designer. So I'm working with designing serious games, gamification programs and platforms, and persuasive games to for learning and in school, in different schools, mostly for people with neurodevelopment disorders.
Ah, excellent. Interesting.
And I also worked with different medical companies that looking into eating disorders and drinking disorders. So mm-hmm. I'm working with games, but more on a serious game, not in entertainment so much.
Yeah. Yeah. Were you part of the same crowd with Matthias, Lilia, and those guys back in the day? Are you sort of old, long time childhood friends of those guys? Is that how you got together?
Actually, no. okay. Sweden is a quite we're not so many people here, but it's quite a big country, the geographically anyway.
Yeah,
I'm based in Gothenburg. And Lilia and those guys are based in Stockholm.
Stockholm, yeah.
And but I connected with Costa Costalis from the Free League when the first iteration of Coriolis was released, more or less. And we started to make some fanzine material, more or less, for the first edition of Coriolis. And I wrote some adventure packs for the first edition. One of the most memorable was it's called Iskallt Inferno in Swedish. It's more Ice Cold Inferno or Inferno Sub Zero.
Yeah.
in a direct translation, and I had so much inspiration from the early John Carpenter movies, and
a man after my own heart.
The Thing, of course. It's about a research base on a cold moon in the Sura system.
We I keep on going on about The Thing because it's one of my favorite movies ever.
Yeah.
And we've done some podcasts for the RPG A Day. And in that, I promised that I wouldn't mention The Thing in this podcast. But you mentioned it first, Adam. So it's okay. It's okay. You mentioned it first. And I didn't prime you to mention it either.
The Thing is a great movie. And it has a good plot. And it's a really good plot for a night of tabletop RPG. You don't know who is the monster. Is the monster even here? And so on and so forth. It's got a real scary take on the human nature and what we are prepared to do to each other when we're looking for the monster. So I really love those themes in pop culture.
Yeah, me too.
So that's one of your favorite scenarios from the first edition of Coriolis, but can you tell us what input have you had on Emissary Lost for this brand new version that's coming out?
Me and Costa Costalas and Richard Antroia wrote the most parts of based on the Lilja material, of course. Richard Antroia was more like an editor, and Costa, he is one of the founding members of Free League. He wrote the first part more or less, and I wrote the second part. It's divided in two different adventure sets.
Let's just clarify that. So obviously this is going to come out as a multi-part epic anyway. Are you saying you wrote the second part of this first book that is currently being kickstarted? Gotcha.
The first chapter, I will not spoil anything, but the first chapter is more intense, space station oriented, and the second part that I wrote is more down planetary, down in the mud kind of thing. I have my sources of inspiration were Joseph Conrad and some literature from South America picked up when I was studying at the university. But because the truth is, I wrote this several years ago, in 2015, maybe 2014. But then the Emissary Lost was in some kind of production limbo, because the whole Coriolis system was going through massive iterations with the rule set, and they didn't they hadn't landed in the Mutant Zero rule set for the Coriolis at the time being, so the narrative was done much a year or so before the rule set was decided.
It's a story that's been waiting to be told, then.
And I think that Atroya's work on the editing was really good, because I wrote the narrative without any rules. I didn't know which rule set I should write the narrative for. So it was very speculative, and I did some notes in the sidelines, but here we can put some interesting game mechanics, but I don't know which. So it's Atroya did a great work. Obviously.
You're with us today because you're going to be running this for our friends over at Red Moon Roleplaying. Have you actually started recording yet, or is that all still about to happen?
We have finished the prologue, the last voice of Gasalis, which Free League Publishing rewrote from the Lilja script. The last voice of Gasalis was one of the original pieces of the first iteration of Coriolis, and it still was the prologue for the main campaign, Emissary Lost. And in the first iteration, I think that the Last Voice of Gasalis had a bigger part to play than it has now in the second iteration. But it's still a great, it's a great piece of adventure, and I really love the narrative. So we stopped recording the Last Voice of Gasalis a week ago, and we shall start with the Emissary Lost in a couple of weeks. It's my fault. The time is dragging out. I got some other deadlines I have to finish before this. So
we all have lives.
we have.
So tell me, Last Voyage of Gasalis, will that be giving us clues about what actually happened in, don't spoil this, but will we find out more about the Taroan incident?
Yeah. You will. I think it's a great adventure to get the players or the player characters into the bigger plot, to get a feel of the bigger plot of the whole Third Horizon faction wars and all that. So I think it's you don't have to play it with the same characters which are playing the MSR Lost, but you should definitely play it to get more feel to the Third Horizon and what it can be expect in later versions in MSR Lost.
So, yeah. That's very interesting. I was going to ask about the characters. I had kind of assumed that a bit like the song for Jiruma, that you might be playing an entirely different set of characters in the last voyage from what you're actually playing in MO3 Lost. Is that right? Or can you carry your characters over if you...
The last voice of Gesalis and MSR Lost is it's very easy to play with the same characters in the both adventure sets. The Jiruma scenario, I haven't read it, but I heard the podcast. It's much more difficult to use the same characters, of course.
That's assuming they survive the last voyage, I guess.
Of course.
I wanted to ask, what can you tell us about the crew? What are the characters we're likely to meet if we listen to the podcast?
We have three very interesting characters. We have a very good-looking and dashing captain from the Dabaran system. And we have a silent but sharp pilot from the Senetian hegemony. And
a silent character for a podcast. You might have to encourage him to talk a bit, I guess.
Hey, I play a silent character for podcast.
You show, don't tell, right? Let the action talk. And we also have a very strange mechanic, and I leave you at that.
Cool. That's interesting. Yeah, our crew also has a Zenithian pilot and a very strange mechanic.
Stereotype for the
Korean one who should be dead. Yes.
Dave, I've been hogging the questions. Have you got any you want to ask?
Well, I was going to talk a little bit about the. The podcast, and so you're going to run through the Emissary Lost campaign as part of that podcast. Is that the plan, to do the whole thing?
Yeah, actually we plan to do the whole thing. We started to make a roadmap to see when we should and how we should perform this, because half of the podcast crew is in London, one fourth is in Malmö, and the other fourth is in Gothenburg. So, and we all got lives, and we all got different projects running. So we are looking how should it even be possible. But I think we are really getting somewhere with the planning and the roadmap. So we are looking into have at least one session recorded every other week. So and we're doing. Quite short sessions, about two, maybe 3 hours. It's more convenient when you're playing in this kind of mode, when you're not engaging with other persons around the table.
So you're going to be looking at sort of a 2-hour episode every couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And how long do you think that'll run then? How long?
It's hard to say.
I mean, this is maybe a bit of a spoiler about how long the actual Emissary Lost campaign will last. But
I got the book here. I can tell you the page number if you hang on a second. Is it okay?
Yeah, of course. That's good. He's got the book. I'm jealous.
Yeah, could you stick that in the post and send it to us, Adam?
It'll be in Swedish.
It's in Swedish, though.
My wife can translate. She's Swedish. So.
How much of the first edition of Coriolis has she translated
none,
so far?
I can tell you that the Gesalis episode took about 4, maybe 5 sessions to record, and it was... Around 61 pages. The Emissary Lost is 250 pages. And then you do the math.
Yep.
So cool. we have some some sessions ahead of us.
You got a lot of playing to do.
Yeah. But it's fun. It's fun. It's and it's quite I have never I listened to Red Moon Role Playing, but I have never played with them. Then Matthias asked me if I wanted to lead this because I was one of the I co-written the Emissary Lost, and I said yes with some thinking because I know it's a massive campaign, and this is the first part of the Emissary Lost. Maybe I cannot tell how many more it will, but at least it will one more Mercy of the Icon part. Two will hit the stores. I don't know, but and it should be at least 250 pages one more time. So it's a long project, but it's a fun project. So it will last.
I was going to ask, do you actually get much time to game as opposed to working on it? But I guess these podcasts should be. Feel more like fun than work, hopefully.
Yeah, they do. But I also do some at my the gamification office. We play Coriolis as well. So we have employer branding every Tuesday. Every other Tuesday, we play Coriolis with me as game master. So I'm getting my share of RPG. I also started play with my wife's, with my wife. cut that out.
How many do you have?
Cut that out, okay? with my
What's
wife.
What's it worth?
and her siblings a year ago. Nice. And my children is soon. One is 4 and the other one is 3. So in a couple of years I can start playing with them as well. So I have a lot of sessions coming up.
But maybe not Coriolis.
No. I'm looking into there's some actually some good Swedish games for the first time players called it's about more about storytelling than rule sets and so on and so forth. Yeah. More like adventure games, actually. But I think they're quite good to start with. I was about, like I said, 10 or 11, but I think my daughters will be 8, 9 when they start.
Start them early.
Yeah.
Coming back to the podcast, Red Moon are going to be releasing this as a bonus for their Patreon backers, is that right?
Yeah.
And so if people want to listen, they're going to have to sign up to Red Moon. I think it's their $3 level.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's $3 a month. So effectively, if you do manage to do an episode every 2 weeks, that's kind of $1.50 an episode.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I think it's money well spent. You get insight of the Coriolis. We also use for this campaign Sirenscape, the RPG tool. Do you know what it is?
Mm-hmm.
Sirenscape to do sound effects, and we adding a lot of different voice scripts and music to it as well, so it's money well spent.
So it's more of a production than just a recording of guys around the table.
Yeah, definitely.
Having a laugh. Yeah. Oh, cool.
And this is the first time you've played with the guys at Red Moon.
Yes.
Do you know them at all? Did you know Mateus beforehand, or did his request come out of the blue?
Hmm. I knew about him. Earlier, I was part of a much smaller podcast, playing new Järnringen RPG called Symbarum. And we just played for fun in Swedish. But Matthias was one of our first enthusiastic listeners and really shared us on. But I stopped recording with this podcast because I got so much to do at work. A year and a half later, Matthias asked me if I could lead the MSR Lost campaign. And I said yes. There's many reasons that I said yes. One is that I love Coriolis, and I also my prep work don't have to be so in such an extent because I wrote the book.
Yeah. You're familiar with it already. Yeah.
So and I really love the Red Moon and what they're doing with the hobby, with the pop culture of RPG. There's a
excellent.
Yeah.
Now, we asked in chat when we were discussing this interview, we asked Matthias whether this might ever be free to more casual podcast listeners. And he said he's got no plans at the moment. But given that we want to, you know, our cause at the Coriolis Effect is to spread the love for Coriolis, I'm just going to say now, you know, publicly that, you know, if he can at some point think to releasing it free to just get more people into the world of Coriolis, we'd love to hear that. We'd love to be able to promote that to people who might not have touched the Third Horizon yet.
No.
But I think we've reached the end of our questions, unless, Dave, you've got any more?
No, I think there's one other thing. I mean, Adam, it's a delight to talk to you. And I think from me as a long time role player and a fan of Coriolis and a lot of the, you know, all the Free League stuff that's out there, you know, I just want to say a big thanks to you and the guys for making such, you know, excellent role playing games.
Oh, thank you.
But there's one thing I'd ask: are there gems from the old sort of Järnringen days of Coriolis, or even in the early days of Coriolis that didn't get produced, that haven't been published yet, that you'd like to see published?
Or any that you'd like to see translated into English?
Yeah, or any you'd like to see translated, yeah.
There are some material that I saw some early drafts at, and I was part of writing them as well. And they never really get to the last product state. Maybe they're in inversion 0.7 or 0.8. But I see some cool stuff. I see some really good drafts, and I really hope that the Free League Publishing is going to release them. Free League has all the drafts, I suppose, so it's up to them. But I know they're choked. They got a lot of things on their table at the moment.
Yeah, I was going to say, I guess there's only so many hours in the day.
Yeah.
To do these things.
Yeah, and I saw. I can give you an example. A really, really good scenario plot and a atlas. It's called. It's called now at the Quadrant of the Pillars. And I was one of the lead writers on that one. And I really hope that they will look into releasing both the compendium and the scenario, because it was fun writing it and we all put a lot of effort into it. So,
yeah, I think Kostas, when we interviewed him in Stockholm, said that was his favourite part of the Horizon.
Yeah,
that he kind of feels he owns a bit. A lot of his imagination's gone in there. So maybe they will.
Yeah, fingers crossed, right?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for joining us, Adam. And as Dave said, you know, thank you for all the work that you've put into the campaign that we're all waiting for and will be out very soon from Free League. And if anybody wants to listen to the Red Moon role-playing, We'll put a link for their normal podcast feed and a link for Patreon into our show notes.
We will.
Thank you. That's great.
Well,
Having read even the little that I have read of Emissary Lost, I can pretty much assure you that Adam was incredibly reserved and didn't let loose a single spoiler in the interview. So it's all to play for.
Yes, excellent. No, it was really good. It was a really good opportunity to chat through some of that stuff with Adam. And I would like to just say one thing to those listeners who listened to the RPG A Day, where I promised not to mention the thing. I didn't mention it. I didn't tee up Adam to mention it. So don't blame me. It wasn't my fault. Honest, Gov. But I won't mention it again. Anyway,
that was hilarious when you said it.
Yes. So I thought, oh God, promise broken already, and it wasn't my fault.
Now, and it's interesting, you know, I expressed my disappointment in that interview that the campaign is hidden behind a paywall.
Mm.
But actually, that's a very good thing. Because players really don't want to be paying their $3 a month to Red Moon Roleplaying so they can listen to the campaign. And if they do want to cheat, then it should cost them $3 a month.
Haha, yeah.
At the very least.
Yeah, so it's something that I don't think we really got into very much, which was obviously it's going to be, if they're starting to run these like soon, it's going to be packed full of spoilers. So that might well put people off from listening to it because they don't want to spoil it for themselves when they come to play it for themselves.
Yeah, no, it's a really interesting quandary for Coriolis fans, actually. But I'll leave it up to you guys, listeners. And if we start, I think we can be pretty sure when we're not going to produce a podcast version of Emissary Lost as an actual play many, many months. So you're pretty safe with us. But yeah, it's an interesting choice to make when Red Moon start doing their thing. Yeah. I want to spread the Coriolis love, but at the same time, part of me wants to go, don't listen to the Red Moon playing podcast. Yeah. Guys, I love you. They do lots of other things. Listen to all those. Listen to Song for Jeruma. I think that could be essential listening. It's you can play that as well. That will be coming out as part of the Kickstarter package, but it isn't quite as spoilery. It's about stuff that we're already aware of.
That happens before, isn't it? Yeah, it's kind of a prequel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, it's kind of a prequel.
Yeah, cool.
Anyway, is it time to talk about poisoning people?
How to play Poisons and Explosions. I think it might be.
Brilliant. So you've recorded a little piece, as is our wont. Let's listen to that.
Agius Mia, Legion Assassin and sometime member of the Spectral Corsair's crew, had the poison in his hand and was ready to kill his target. He crept into the woman's bedchamber and hid the aerosol containing the deadly poison, called Fury, a poison with a strength of 8, the strongest in the Third Horizon. Once in place, the aerosol would slowly release the poison into the air, and the victim would surely die quietly in her sleep. Then I got the rules wrong. The poison was rubbish and was never going to kill her, so Agit shot her instead. But that said, even if I'd followed the rules as written, the poison couldn't possibly have killed the target anyway. Poisons have an attack strength between 1 and 8, with up to 5 being the most common, and that's the number of dice rolled in a poison attack. The strength of the poison is tested against a specific stat in an opposed roll. Against strength for something like cyanide, perhaps, or empathy for a psychedelic poison. If the victim resists, they suffer -1 die to the attacked stat for 1d6 hours. But if the poison wins, the victim takes the full strength of the poison as damage, to either hit points or stress, depending on the stat that's targeted by the poison in the first place. But poison has no crit value, so even a maximum hit with the strongest poison will only deliver 8 damage to hit points. The victim might be broken, but there's no way he's going to die. So either the poisoners of the Third Horizon are chronically crap at mixing up poisons, or the rules need a little shake-up. I think there might be two ways to sharpen up the potential deadliness of poisons. The simplest way would be to say that if a victim is broken by the poison, they take an immediate crit. This could work, but the poison would still have to be pretty strong to have a decent chance of breaking the target, and then the crit roll is unlikely to kill them. And of course, this would only apply to poisons that target a victim's strength or agility. If a psychedelic drug targeting empathy or wits broke the target, they will be down, but not take a critical hit at all. A second method would be to add a damage and a crit value to poisons. The poison attack would still be resolved by an opposed roll. The number of successes the poison achieves is equal to the number of sixes rolled over and above the victim. This would work well for poisons that attack the physical attributes, but would weaken the efficacy of poisons that target empathy or wits. The book implies that you can add specific effects to poisons like paralysis, but there are no rules about how to manage this. So it's entirely up to you, as GM, to add some poison spice to your games. I've used the paralysis effect in my campaigns. The Diamondback's Kiss, derived from the venom of the equatorial diamondback snake found in the deserts of Lubao. It's an autonomic suppressant that can be delivered in multiple ways, but in my scenario it was delivered by smoking a hookah. The poison has strength of 8, targeted against agility. And for every success, the victim loses 2 points of agility for 2d6 turns. If agility is reduced to 0, the victim is paralyzed but conscious. And once the duration of the poison expires, the victim recovers 1 point of agility per hour. The book also says that poisons cost between 300 and 3,000 burr per dose, and are listed as primitive tech. I'm not sure about this last point. I mean, Novichok certainly is not primitive. Now explosives. In Coriolis, explosives have a blast power. It can be anything up to 15, but usually 6 or 9. And they have a damage rating and a crit rating. Most only have an effect up to close range. And remember, that's only up to 2 meters. But some do reach as far as short range, which is up to 20 meters. All those within the blast radius take a hit. You can either roll a separate attack for each target, or roll once for all, depending on how many victims you've got packed into the blast radius. And remember that it's a ranged combat check if you want to lob a grenade or a stick of dynamite. So that's all pretty straightforward, and I think works well enough. On top of that, some explosives have special effects. Either stun, which I'll come back to in a moment, or fire. The fire effect obviously means that the victims start to suffer a fire attack as well as the impact of the explosion, either at 2 or 3 attack dice, and with a crit of 1. The attack dice increase by 1 every turn until you stop, drop and roll, or a mate puts the fire out for you. But stun. I have a problem with the stun mechanic as a whole in Coriolis. Sure, the idea of having a stress value that could put you out of action is cool, but without an equivalent stress critical hit table, it becomes pretty hard to put somebody down with stress. Stun weapons, and that includes stun grenades, simply inflict damage to stress rather than to hit points. Even a lucky attack roll is unlikely to do enough stress damage to put a man down in one go, which seems pretty weak to me. Surely the idea of a stun weapon is to temporarily incapacitate a victim quickly and possibly quietly. Having very little hope of doing this in one blow completely negates the attractiveness of stunning someone, when you're just as well off hitting for hit points, converting all your successes into hit point damage rather than crits, and achieving the same outcome, probably more effectively, by breaking the target on hit points. I don't know if anyone has seen a modern day flashbang grenade go off, but if you're close to it, you are going to be stunned, and your immediate reaction, if you're even able to think at all, is to get away from that noise. So I think stun grenades and weapons should be managed differently. They should still inflict their basic damage as hit point damage for the first success that's rolled. I mean, getting shot or blown up by anything is still going to hurt. But a critical success is the stun instead of a roll on the critical hit table. And that critical effect should be more than just doing stress damage instead. It should allow the possibility of putting the target down, if only for a moment. So if a stun attack crits, and thus delivers a stun of fact. The victim must roll to resist the stun, using empathy dice, and needing to score as many successes as there were sixes rolled in the attack. If they fail, they are stunned for the next round, during which they get another resist roll, with their target number reduced by one. If they succeed the resist roll, they can operate as normal.
Well, I know I didn't ask you to talk about stun, but those are some very good observations on the stun mechanic, which is hardly a mechanic in the book, isn't it? It's a little point of confusion. I've seen people discussing it on the forum and things like that. And what you've got there seems to me quite a workable solution.
Yeah, I always just thought that, I mean, I really like the idea of having stress points as well as hit points. I think that's a really good thing, but the game doesn't really make enough of it, I don't think. So, and having a stun mechanic, you know, a stun special effect, which simply does stress damage rather than hit points damage. Well, okay, it's fine, but it's doesn't really do anything else. You can't crit with it. So I think, you know, if you want to play a character that wants to stun somebody, I think, you know, you might want to do it because you're a covert operative and you want to put them down straight away. And the rules as they are, as written, don't allow you to do that. My little bugbear.
I mean, I guess you can make that sort of covert character do that with breaking them on hit points as opposed to stress.
Yeah.
With a, you know, to one-shot them effectively and break them without necessarily dealing them a critical hit and killing them.
Yeah.
But, it then kind of makes the whole point of stress points a little bit redundant, unless it's purely mental attack. So, and then when, you know, if you're using stress points for when weird creatures zap them with their minds, then how does a stun gun fit in with that?
Mm-hmm.
But as I say, I think you've got some useful solutions there. If people want to experiment with them, I think they should. Poisons as well. You know, it's interesting. I've just been reading about poisons in Forbidden Lands, and it all seems so much simpler there in Forbidden Lands. And in a way, what you've done with the poisons is something that's a bit more like the Forbidden Lands solution.
Mm.
But of course, this is all effectively a problem with the fact that they, for I think very good reasons, merge strength and agility into hit points and your mental characteristics into stress points, so that you can't attack each of those individually. In many other parts of play, I think that's probably a good thing, but things like the poison mechanics are a little bit broken by that thing with hit points,
aren't they? Yeah, and as the rules are written as well, there is no crit from it, so there is absolutely no way you can die from a poison in Coriolis with the rules as written, because you get broken. Great, you're broken. You know, you come back after a good night's sleep. So, I think that didn't strike me as being, you know, quite how I'd want it, and particularly when the scenario I ran with Morgan and Dean, my sons, when Morgan had the great idea of trying to sneak in and use an aerosol delivered poison to kill his target. I hadn't even realised at that point that the poison couldn't kill the target anyway. And we got into a confrontation in the bedroom between the target, the target's guards, and Ajit Mir, Morgan's character. And Morgan was like, "Well, why the hell am I here? I should have known that poison was never, ever going to work." And he got a bit grumpy because he started looking like he was going to get killed. But he managed to escape. But So I think having a mechanism whereby a poison can kill you is probably a good thing. And obviously I offered two potential solutions about how to do it. The first one, where if you're broken, you take a crit, is the simplest one, but you still need to do a lot of damage in order to get the crit in the first place. So somebody who was particularly robust with, you know, 9 or 10 hit points, again, if you cap the poison strength at 8, which is what they do in the game, but I mean, you don't have to, you could have more powerful ones. But if you do limit it to that, then obviously people with hit points of 9 or 10, again, can't be killed by poison, full stop. So it's... So yeah, I've put out a couple of ideas there for people to think about.
I think they're all good ideas, all very useful. Not quite clarifications, but extensions.
Mm.
And also, you've given us grenades. What do you... there's been a lot of confusion over the grenade rules in forums. I think I pretty much sorted it out in a discussion that a whole bunch of us had on one of the forums.
Yeah.
But you've cut through all that.
So when I was writing this, I was reading through the rules and I thought, the explosives rules sound actually... They sound okay. They're much more... They're basically gun rules, but with an area of effect impact. And I thought, that's fine. That's going to work really well. And then in the game that I ran last night, which I'll talk about a little bit, there's a lot of bombs going off. And there are suicide bombers, basically, trying to kill the players. And Hanbal, Tony's character, had, on two occasions... a person with a suicide vest get to him and detonate it, and it didn't kill him. And so again, the rules are a little bit broken in that, because I was house ruling that the guys, the Zelosian acolytes who are committing suicide, they would die as a result of the explosion, which I think is fair enough. If you've got a suicide vest on, you set it off, you're not going to be very well after that. But rolling the dice, even with 9 dice for the explosives. One of them did give Tony a crit, which was a minor crit, broke his foot. But the other one, I got no successes at all. And so this guy set the bomb off right next to him, literally had run up to him and grabbed him and set it off without doing him any harm whatsoever. And the way we sort of narrated it in the game was that Tony managed to scrabble under the ramp of the ship where they were fighting, so was shielded from the blast. But still, I think there's a range thing. You probably have to make the danger of explosives at close range really dangerous. If you're within 2 meters of a bomb going off, it's going to be bad. A bit further away, up to short range, 20 meters, then, you could get away with, I think, there would be occasions, I'm sure, at that range where you wouldn't suffer a really serious injury, depending on how strong the explosive was, of course. So it didn't feel right to have a suicide bomber effectively sat on Tony, detonating the device, him being splattered, and Tony being not affected at all. So that didn't feel right.
No, it's always interesting. I think the part of the problem here is how grenades work in film and TV compared to how they work in actual war, In actual war, you use them to clear a room, pretty much.
Yeah.
And you throw one in, and the room is pretty much cleared. On film and TV, you use them to create a wonderful explosion for our heroes to walk away from nonchalantly.
Yeah.
Or to possibly leap over their heads from, slightly panically. But, you know, the key thing about grenades is they generally don't do much harm to our heroes. And I guess game designers possibly think, well, we ought to, let's weight it in that direction rather than the realistic direction where everybody dies.
That's a fair enough comment, although I would say everything else in Coriolis combat system doesn't give the players that latitude. It's like, fuck you players, oh no, explosives, they don't want to hurt you with those.
Yeah, but I think it's not necessarily, it's not limited to this game. I'm pretty sure... Phoenix Dawn, or Phoenix Command, not Phoenix Dawn Command. That old system probably was really deadly with grenades.
Yeah.
But
so I think
but most games, I think, kind of underpower grenades and explosions in favour of the players.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And I was working on the assumption when I was setting up this scene that the players were going to be desperately trying to gun down these guys as they're running towards them, which was the kind of feel I wanted to put into it. I hadn't expected that, Tony's die rolling... Well, I should have expected, actually. I hadn't anticipated that Tony's die rolling would be so bad that a couple of them would get through. And I did expect somebody potentially to die in the scenario because I thought it was going to be quite a dangerous one.
What? Tell us all about what's been happening lately in Spectral Corsair.
So the last scenario, had we had to stop right in the middle of the action, as it were, because we ran out of time on the day. And we'd left it with the crew about to assault a ship that they'd created to look like... it was a trap to draw out the witch smeller, Mariam. And it succeeded. She was on the ship with some acolytes, and they were just about to assault the ship with some Legion support. The first thing that happened in the scenario was the Legion support was suddenly withdrawn, because just before they assaulted the ship, the what was called the Coriolis Insurrection happened, and fighting broke out in the cellar, and there were a few sporadic battles broke out across the whole station, and the Legion were involved in a rearguard action at the lift to the cellar, trying to stop these Zelosian insurgents getting actually out onto the core. So it was a real drama and potential disaster for the Legion. So every troop was being sent to try and repel and then quash the resistance that was being sprung up around the station. So suddenly they were left on their own to assault the ship and take down the witch smeller. They had a bit of a debate about whether they were going to do that or not. And ultimately, Hanbal, as the captain, said, "I'm not going to order an assault unless we're all in." And eventually, they all sort of said, "Okay, yes, we ought to assault the ship." And it was getting across the hangar to the ship itself, where they were coming under attack from these acolytes who were suicide bombers. They managed to get past that fight. Hanbal took an injury and had a broken foot. One of the others had another relatively minor critical injury that wasn't going to kill them. Norsa took a knife to the leg and had a critical injury there, but he was saved as a result of the fight. And they ended up in a bit of a stalemate, with Mariam being on the cargo deck of the Golden Griffin, which is the ship where they'd laid the trap to draw her out. And they were outside, and she was setting off or building up her armor, which is Zelosian animated armor, to detonate, a bit like Predator in Predator. And She was giving them an opportunity to escape, to leave, which was perplexing them somewhat. And then she spoke to them and said, "It doesn't have to end this way. Perhaps you can actually help me and I can help you." And this is all very confusing to them. They didn't quite know what to do. And then she said, "I'm not what you think. I'm not actually a witch smeller." And they were, "Okay, what the hell's going on? You look like a witch smeller. You're dressed in witch smeller armor. That kind of, in their books, makes you a witch smeller." And she said, "Well, I actually work for Alarm's Temple." And so they ended up negotiating with her and decided that they would help her get off the station, fooling the Legion. I mean, none of them had any real strong loyalty to the Legion, and I'm not quite sure why they decided. I think they decided to carry on with the assault when they had the option to leave, largely on the basis that they'd get into a lot of trouble, and that they would then be at odds with both the Legion and the Order of the Pariah. But now, when they were kind of faced with the situation, it was a hard fight, it was a dangerous fight, they found a third way. They found another way out. So they've agreed that they'll take her off Coriolis and take her to Menkar, which is where there is a Alarm's Temple, sort of centre of administration almost, or a secret centre, because they can't take her to Alarm's Temple on Coriolis, obviously. And they don't want to fly through Zalos to get to Myra, where the other centre of Alarm's Temple's power is concentrated. And that's where we left it. So they've just left Coriolis on this journey. And we'll see where that takes them.
That's all very exciting. And, it's a bit of a switcheroo.
Yeah.
Is it a recent switcheroo? Did you really plan to have Alarm's Temple come in? Or did you change your mind and introduce them either on the spur of the moment or after you did your Alarm's Temple essay last month?
So I decided that she should be Alarm's Temple at about quarter to 10 last night during the game.
I knew it!
Because I'd been struggling a little bit about whether the campaign was going in the right direction. And having changed it from the traders, where actually the players get a lot of choice and they get a lot of freedom to do what they want, to a setup of a campaign setup where they're kind of being given a mission and they go and do the mission, and then they get another mission and go and do a mission. And I didn't get the sense that the players were really enjoying that in the same way that they were enjoying the freedom of being traders who could run around and make their own minds up. So I wanted to give them the opportunity to, in-game, make a character decision, crew decision, that would then guide me as the GM about what kind of game they wanted to play. And it was clear they weren't very keen on being stooges of the Legion. It was clear that they didn't just want to run either, because of the trouble that would get them in. They'd have to run to the rim somewhere and then hide out a bit, probably, they thought. So this gives them a third way whereby they've now got another reasonable justification for doing what they're doing. And it does give me plenty of other campaign story opportunities to move on by bringing in the Alarms Temple. So, it worked out really well, I thought. I was quite pleased with that sort of eureka moment. And it actually works out really well as well in the wider... I won't talk about it now because it will give spoilers. But immediately there were things I was thinking about further down the line and about, okay, why was she doing what she's doing? That then just all fell into place immediately. Just went click, 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 click. And everything just gelled really well when I had the idea, sat around the table in the upstairs room of the pub yesterday. I thought, okay, let's go with that.
Excellent. So you've written notes on that, so you remember that moment of clarity,
yes.
I hope.
Yes, yes.
It'll all make perfect sense in the future.
Yes.
Funny enough, actually, my campaign has had a similar thing where suddenly everything fell into place. But this was a story idea I had seeded pretty much the last time you and I played Coriolis, which was in November last year.
Yeah.
And
was that long
I
ago,
got an
wasn't
idea
it?
In
Blimey.
There, and it finally reached fruition in this scenario here. I ought to just check before I start talking about mine. Are we done on yours?
Yes, that's where we left it. They're heading to the portals in the Kua system to go to Iwaz and stop off at Trini to get some work, because they are also desperately out of money.
Excellent. So, let me tell you about the Al-Muqaddiya campaign.
Please.
Last time we
do.
Talked about them, they had been doing the pre-published scenario, whose name I've just forgotten.
Was it the...
With the ice trawler?
Dying Ship.
The Dying Ship. Yeah. Thank you very much. And that was just kind of to ease us all into it and to start working out what everybody's relationships were. I didn't make them... do their relationship thing until after we'd played that, and that probably worked quite well, although there's an interesting problem which I want to discuss with you shortly. So if you like, this was going to be the beginning of our proper campaign, which is the bit that I've written as opposed to just taking the pre-published scenario. There was immediately a bit of a blocker on that, though, because, as I told you last time, brilliantly, one of the player characters had managed to get himself possessed by a djinn, which was great. And I thought, this is brilliant. And I will write a scenario about that and about being driven by this possession to this particular place and to retrieve this object. And then that opens up this, and this opens up that. Yeah, that will work nicely, and we'll go with that. But then, just as we were ready to start, Jace said, who's the player, he's an artist by trade, and he's got a big exhibition coming up, and realised he had a lot of framing to do for this exhibition, and said, look, I'm going to have to take a few weeks out while I concentrate on getting this stuff done. And I really didn't want to run the scenario I prepared without him, because he's the guy with the possession. So I said, "Oh, we're going to have to delay this until he comes back." And we, you know, we struggled about thinking, you know, is there something else we can play in the meantime? And we did play actually something else which we quite enjoyed, and that something else was the Expanse Kickstarter.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, I'll be interested.
Maybe we'll talk about that next time.
Yeah, I'd be interested to hear your views after our comment of our discussion on RPG A Day. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. maybe at the end of the program, we'll see how long we're doing before we get on.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we did that Expanse Kickstarter, but then we still had the rest of the month to fill, and just the weekend before. A couple of weeks ago, suddenly an idea came to my head. And these guys, as you know, are members of the Nazarene Sacrifice. Therefore, you know, they're a hidden organization. And they've been a little bit empowered by your characters stealing the Soliloquy of Sacrifice. And then a bunch of people we played with at Dragon Meet releasing digital copies of that Soliloquy of Sacrifice, which I still don't quite understand why they did that, but let's go with that. They released it around the verse, so now this banned book is being read by all sorts of people. And I thought, when these guys wanted to be evil guys who went around with dead people on their ship, I thought, well, you know, this all fits with the storyline that's developing across three different player groups here. I can go with this. This is my version of the Horizon.
Yeah.
And it's time for them to rise. Apparently. Anyway.
Also,
moving on quickly and swiftly. I thought, of course, the problem is none of these individual cells of the Soliloquy of Sacrifice knows who the other one is. So I could do an entirely Coriolis-based game where I had already said, rather than paying a mortgage on their ship, they had to pay a teeth, which is remarkably similar to the price you pay back on your ship. They'd been told by the guys back on Zib, where they started, that they just had to find the local clave, as I've called them, of the Nazarene Sacrifice, and give them the money every month, and work out which their local clave was and try and get the right person. And I thought, well, we could base a whole adventure around that. Can they find an organisation on Coriolis that's trying to remain hidden? And even if it's to give them a bunch of money, 14,000 burr they owed them.
It's a lot of cash.
I thought that was an interesting little thing that kind of introduces them into the weirdness of this. It might tempt them to say, well, we'll keep the money ourselves, because surely we are the most important people in the Nazarene Sacrifice on the station at the moment. Maybe we should just spend the money on the cool stuff of our own. They didn't go that way, though. They set about honestly trying to find the stuff. And our captain is a preacher, and he'd just given himself a mystic talent with the experience points in the previous scenarios of being able to hold seances and answer questions.
Cool.
So he started off with that, and I thought, that's brilliant. It's not quite what I had planned in terms of getting the clues to this, but let's run with this. So I gave them a bit of a vision that directed them to Merez Alkan, who is the guy that commissioned you to steal the beast statuette.
Yep. Yep.
And in the scenario that's in the back of the book. And I have imagined that he was stealing that for somebody else, but then when he realised the power, or maybe it's been communicating with him, it's turned him into a follower of the Nazarene Sacrifice. Mm. And with his underworld connections, he has become chief Nazarene Sacrifice person on Coriolis. So he's the guy they're meant to be finding and giving the money to. And I gave him that vision. I gave him a vision of his face sort of flickering in Doctor Who style special effects with the face of the beast statuette. And that was kind of the only clue I gave them. Oh, I also gave them a bit of his surroundings, and he's hiding in the cellar. not any old cellar, the cellar on Coriolis.
Yeah.
And he's building himself a cadaver clock. Mm. And they got little flavours of that. But then how to get that vision and connect it with an actual place on Coriolis, particularly because they were new, they hadn't twigged about the cellar at this point. So they were wandering around a bit and checking out the preachers on the spice parlor to see whether, or the spice plaza to give them, to see whether any of them were, you know, preaching Nazarene sacrifice stuff. And nobody was going to be doing that, because I'm trying to say the Nazarene sacrifice are indeed a hidden bunch of people who hide from society.
Highly illegal. That
so nobody's going to be, the Third Horizon, even in the Spice Plaza, going, no, worship the beast only.
That the Third Horizon has spent 60 years trying to eradicate and destroy.
Yes.
Yeah. Not a good idea.
Not in the very centre of the consortium, you know, where the Legion are walking past. Yeah. That's not going to work. But I did thought, I did have a clue prepared for exactly that emergency. And that was Lavim Tam, the guy who'd originally found the beast statuette, who, in my version, after you'd left him, has acquired mystic powers himself and become a bit of a preacher.
Ah.
So they met him there. They also met the young woman that... Andy's character had a bit of interaction with while you were doing that.
Oh, yeah.
Who, I'll tell you now, because you guys have moved beyond this, so it's not a spoiler. She was a Draconite.
Yeah.
And she was trying to recover the beast. Now her mission is to try and see what the local chapter or clave of the Nazarene sacrifice are doing on Coriolis. And so she was... They noticed her following them around a bit and managed to turn the tables on her, follow her to where she was based, and discover some clues that said that she might not be the beggar girl that she appeared to be to them. But they didn't really get much further than that. And then they went off in an entirely different direction, which was brilliant, but caught me a bit by surprise. They decided to go to the university. They'd discovered Lavim Tam had been an archaeologist, and so they went to the foundation thinking they can find some clues about his mission there. And I thought, well, I hadn't actually planned this. But I had planned some other stuff. So when you went to get the Soliloquy of Sacrifice, you never discovered this, but the agent that had given you that mission was working for the foundation. And my backstory for this is that they want secrets to portal creation, which they think the Nazarene sacrifice hold and may be hidden in the Soliloquy of Sacrifice.
Yeah.
So it was all about them discovering the knowledge, the forbidden knowledge, and they wanted you to steal that book. And if you'd succeeded and had delivered the book, then they'd just have that information. As it turns out, you didn't succeed. You got shot to shit.
We had no chance of succeeding. Caught. We had no chance because it was just raining.
No, you'd built up too many darkness points in my pool. Built and then when I spent the darkness points, you just spent more.
So I know, because we had to.
More reinforcement.
We had to spend the darkness points because you were being so bloody difficult as a GM and being so evil. and then we had to spend even more when you were spending the ones that we'd already given you. It's like, oh, outrageous.
Yeah. Anyway, so the book didn't get into their hands. I then used that as inspiration for the dragon meat scenario, where I then sent some investigators from the council to investigate your crime, and they had released it. And actually, it was a foundation player there who kind of convinced everybody that they should release it. So without even knowing it, she was kind of doing the foundation's agenda. I mean, she might have. I might well
doing,
have said something.
You mean doing
like,
the Nazarene sacrifices agenda, not the foundation's?
Well... At the moment, the Foundation think they're working for themselves. Anyway, okay. These guys went to the Foundation to ask about the archaeological dig where Lavim Tam had discovered this thing, which wasn't something I prepared for at all. So I quickly rolled up a character using the fabulous chart and came up with this woman with a beard, because it said, you know, it said, what's her distinguishing feature? She's got a beard. And I was describing her as I was rolling the dice. Who I then said, because of course she's been trying to get hold of this book, she might know a few of the secrets, so I said that she had a secret handshake that marked her out as a member of the Nazarene sacrifice. And they bought it hook, line and sinker. they now here's, there's a challenge here in that Two of the players were paid-up members of Nazarene Sacrifice. One of them, Sophia, the pilot, has always said, I'm not part of this. I don't know what they're doing. I want, you know, I want to be just a pilot working on this and, you know, maybe discover what the true horror of what they're doing later in the game. And, of course, they then had to send her away from that meeting because they wanted to talk Nazarene Sacrifice stuff.
Yeah.
So they did. And they sent her back to check on the ship. And then the two of them met with her and immediately sort of handed over the cash that they'd been collecting. They'd taken little bits of cash out of all sorts of cash points so that it would be untraceable. And they had a big bag of burr to give her. And they gave it to her. And she said, oh, this will be a lovely a donation to the orphans fund. And passed it on to her secretary. And and then spread, you know, suggested that she might be the highest ranking member of the Nazarene Sacrifice on the station to them. And I gave them all sorts of clues, like her not knowing very much, even admitting that she was only a recent convert. And they didn't test this at all. And they gave her the cash. And between them, they worked out that Merez Alcan had got the statuette. And she said, you need to get that statuette off him. He's apostate. He shouldn't have that. I need that. We need that. And she showed them the original book which she had stolen, which I imagine now that it had been somehow transferred into the Foundation's thing. So that kind of sealed the deal for them.
Right.
She was obviously kosher.
Yeah.
Or obviously sacrifices.
Yeah.
Exactly the opposite of kosher, I think, probably. And that's where the scenario ended.
Cool.
Or that's where the session ended that week. And then we came back just last night, at which point he said, you know, I wonder whether we were a bit too trusting. At which point I kind of just burst into laughter and said, yeah, I think so, given that I rolled her up. You know, she wasn't an NPC. And you've just given her all your money. So, you know, they did think that maybe they'd made a bit of a mistake. And this time they tracked down Merez Alcan very well. They had another bit of an encounter with the Draconite agent, Solyndra. And here we come to an important point. I'm desperate. When you've got two guys who are part of a conspiracy and a third player who isn't part of that conspiracy, and I'd invented the scenario, which is about just delving a bit deeper into the conspiracy, I realised I had nothing actually for Sophia to do.
Yeah.
And that's a problem.
Yes,
so
yeah.
For the first scenario, I just played that and I didn't really think about it until the end of that. I thought, well, I didn't actually have much to do. And particularly, it was driven home when they had to send her away so they could talk with the woman. Luckily, she had to go and catch a train anyway, the player did. So this was in the last 20 minutes of the session. And so she didn't have to sit there listening to them not tell her stuff.
Yeah.
But still, I didn't actually have anything to do. So over the intervening week, I thought that the Draconite would try and make contact with her, seeing her as a weak point in the crew.
Okay, cool.
And try and build a relationship with her and maybe give her a task. Now, interestingly, she collaborated with the crew to make sure that the rest of the crew heard the Draconite making these approaches, which wasn't my plan.
Okay.
So that, you know, I still haven't got a secret mission. But then a bit later on, when they were looking for Merez Alcan in the sewers and there's a big bazaar in there, they were looking at all sorts of stuff. She went off on her own to try and find a job. Now, I rolled up a job randomly. You know, she said I wanted to do a smuggling job or something like that. So I gave her the traders. I pulled the traders' tables out of the compendium and we rolled up a job. It's quite a easy job just on the roll of the dice. But then she said afterwards, or not afterwards, but in a little pause in the game, she said, the reason I want to get this job is I want to take this talent with my experience points. And the talent she's chosen is the assassin talent.
Okay.
So I'm thinking, oh, well, I wouldn't have given you the smuggling job. I'd have done something with the woman and anyway, so she doesn't want to just reveal that she's got this. She spent the money on the talent, but she doesn't just want to reveal it. She wants to have a storyline where she acquires it in some way. So that's my problem, is it's, you know, it's all very well having great fun with a bunch of people who want to be chaotic evil, but when one of them doesn't, particularly if you've made up a scenario on the fly, it's difficult to fit that person into the chaotic evil party.
Yeah.
I'm going to try and probably make her a Draconite agent. I wonder even whether I might retcon it with her in agreement.
Yeah.
Say maybe that's what you've always been.
Potentially. It's always difficult when you've got a group who have motivations or storylines that are potentially diametrically opposed to one another. And it makes life... It's likely to be, something that's probably relatively short-lived in campaign terms. Because eventually the crunch will come where, it all comes out and you have to decide how do you compromise between the group. So I think it's thinking about the line of the campaign where, you're running it with me, Tony and Andy. Yaphet and Salah? Is it Salah or Salem?
Yes.
Salem, I think, isn't it?
Oh.
Tony's Salah.
Andy's character is Salem.
Yeah.
Your brother is Salah.
Yeah. So with Yaphet and Salem, we are likely to come to some sort of crunch because he's turning ever more against the Nazarene sacrifice and I'm turning ever more towards it. So it's...
Yes.
And that's fine. As long, I guess, it is fine. It's an interesting thing to play out, actually. You don't want necessarily to do it with every campaign or every game you run, but getting to a point where two characters, player characters, might have to have a go at each other, it's not a bad one, actually. Once in a while.
Funny enough, Andy texted me earlier this week, or within the last couple of weeks anyway, saying, we're going to have to do something about this. Because I can see I'm going to come to blows with Yaphet.
Yeah.
And I said, well, let's not worry about it at the moment, because first of all, you've got to get off a prison planet. And so you have. You have got to get off a prison planet.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe you both won't get off. Who can tell?
Oh, it's quite possible. Maybe neither of us will get off.
Yes. And we start roll up a whole new bunch of characters. I'll make sure that you're probably not Nazarene sacrifice, given stuff that I've been reading. But say no more about that.
Yeah.
Damn, I've spoiled it. it was a really enjoyable campaign. I love that seed I planted in that mission that you guys had to rescue the thing came to track. And Meraz Alkan has just explained that to this party. So it's not as marvellous as if I'd been explaining it to you and you'd realised, that's the story. But I'm explaining it to you now. Anyway, I'm very pleased with how it's gone so far.
Excellent.
There is a moment, I will just say this about the Emissary Lost campaign. There is a moment where I might want to retcon some stuff. Just that little clue there.
Okay.
They might play an important part in the very beginning of the campaign. Which would mess your two timelines up a bit, but it's an opportunity that I'll have to resist very hard to do that.
Okay. Well, sometimes
I've been talking for a long time
about
that, but I want to talk some more, and I want to talk about their ship.
Yep. Well,
the Al-Mukhadir.
Let's move straight on to that then.
For icon worshippers across the horizon, including the Church of the Icons and the Order of the Pariah, it is traditional to cremate the dead, except those revered as saints. Their holy bodies are preserved so that their spirits may continue to find a way to the horizon and continue their good work. One of the many heresies that the Nazarene sacrifice were accused of was their insistence that every initiated member of the cult was a saint, to the horror and disgust of other societies. No dead cultist of the Nazarene sacrifice was cremated. Instead, the beautiful dead were interred on charnel ships, which constantly plied the dark between the stars. Nazarene charnel ships were never designed for atmospheric entry. Generally, class 4 or 5, they were serviced by shuttle and supply ships. Their main hull took the form of an ancient boat lying on its side, heading keel first into the dark. Two huge archaic graviton projectors extended rearwards. The macabre cargo was kept externally, the vacuum of space, desiccating and preserving the bodies of the saints, while giving their spirits the opportunity to commune with the dark between the stars. The structure that holds the dead is a scaffold frame between the graviton projectors, which can expand as more bodies are added. It is built around the entrance to the hangar, so that cortege shuttles could pause on their way into the hangar to inter the saintly cargo in their appointed place on the scaffold. When the horizon turned against the Nazarene sacrifice in the early years of the Portal Wars, it was considered a matter of both faith and hygiene to instruct the Legion to seek out and destroy every charnel ship that the sacrificed had launched. It is doubtful whether this task was completed. With the arrival of the Zenith, the Legion gradually became distracted by other tasks. There are rumours of ships of the dead still plying the space lanes. And there is at least one still in operation. The Al-Mudakhir is hundreds of years old. No one knows its yard of construction, and some have suggested that it may have been built in orbit around Al-Arda itself in the first horizon. How it survived the Purge is unknown. Al-Mudakhir features ancient glyph-type 8-point armour that predates the sort used by the Order of the Pariah. Apart from being very hard to actually look at, the armour can negate all damage from an incoming attack. This generates 2 darkness points for the GM. If the attack is a torpedo attack, 3 darkness points are generated. This effect can only be used once for regular attacks and once for torpedo attacks in a spaceship combat. Like every charnel ship, it carries its cargo externally. There are around 1,250 tons of corpses in the scaffolding that projects from the aft of the vessel, between the 2 old and outsized graviton projectors. In theory, if there is a revival of the sect, and many more adherents to inter, the cargo scaffold could extend even further. A cloistered arboretum of remembrance sits below the base of the cargo scaffold. It's a long, square walk with a number of stopping places, benches, tables and chairs or water features. Looking up, the plexiglass ceiling reveals the ranks of the dead stacked high above. The artificial gravity on board is orientated so that aft is up and down points to the keel of the ship and the direction of travel. The Arboretum has become the de facto social space for the crew because the crew quarters are 20 basic coffin-style bunks with shared facilities. There is also, of course, a stasis hold, which, as usual for a ship of this size, holds up to 60 people in stasis. The bridge is on the lowest deck at the front of the vessel. The consoles are set around a large round plexiglass viewport set in the floor, which can be disconcerting to visitors as the ship appears to be falling through space. The original Nazarene sacrifice chapel, with its cadaver clock, is still in place, but to disguise the true nature of the ship, a more normal 9-icon chapel has been retrofitted around it. Access to the cadaver clock is now through a secret door in the Dancer's alcove. None of the crew actually know what the cadaver clock does. So many mysteries of the sacrifice were lost in the purging. Close to the false chapel is a chapel of rest, which has been fitted out to do double duty as a med lab. Other modifications to the vessel include a number of weapon systems. There is a torpedo launch system, currently stocked with 4 ancient antimatter torpedoes. Given that this ammunition costs almost a third of the value of the ship, the crew are advised to use them only as a last resort. Even more recently, the vessel was fitted with a data pulse system and an accelerator cannon. The current crew have not yet explored the entire ship, but they do know there is a workshop and a hangar, which contains a vessel especially commissioned for their mission. The Clave of the Nazarene Sacrifice, which sponsored this mission, have commissioned a modern Class II shuttlecraft to act as the ship's shuttle and its public face. In an effort to disguise the true nature of Al-Mudakhir and its crew, The Clave ordered Charon from the Chelebs shipyard of Myra, heart of the Icon Church. Its living quarters include four coffins and a more standard cabin. There is a concealed section in the hold for the transport of illicit cargo, such as stolen relics. Its only defence is an autocannon. Designed for atmospheric entry, it leaves its more macabre mothership hidden in the dark of space. Charon is equipped with a ship's intelligence to make it semi-autonomous, capable of operating without a pilot if required. With its brand new, precise thrusters, it is a very capable flyer. However, it takes its mission to hide the true nature of its crew and protect them from exposure very seriously, which can make it somewhat more obtuse than obedient. Together, these two ships and their crew are on a risky mission, emboldened by the discovery of a copy of a book once thought lost, A Soliloquy of Sacrifice, and the Council's decision to publicly release the text. The sacrifice clave hidden on Zib have repurposed the Al-Mudakhir to seek out other claves around the horizon, and especially to recover the knowledge and artifacts that, since the purging, have been hidden or lost for generations.
I love that ship. I think the ideas behind it are outstanding. They're really good, really good.
Thank you. Thank you.
A couple of things.
Next time somebody asks me what's the best compliment anybody's ever paid you in gaming, I'll remember that.
Yes, and he didn't even have to pay me to say it either. So two things very briefly are just mention. Firstly, I mean, you talked a bit about Sophia, your character, your player. Is Sophia the player or the character?
Sophia is the player. Nadira is her character.
Nadira. How, if Nadira is the pilot of the ship, how does she not notice that you've got thousands of bodies hanging off the outside of it?
Well, I think we've got the idea that this is an, you know, this is an ancient ship.
It's an empty
it's
one.
300 years old.
It's got no. Sorry? It's got no bodies on it. It's empty.
It's got a good cargo of bodies on it. Yes, it does have a good cargo of bodies.
And they're on the outside of the ship.
And they're on the outside of the ship. In this sort of scaffolding contraption.
Refer to the question that I posed just a moment ago. Then, is she blind?
Well, I think she might think it's an old tradition, but entirely acceptable with the Nine Icons and not necessarily anything to do with the Nazarene sacrifice.
Okay.
You know, and she might even twig that the Nazarene sacrifice are a thing, but may not put that together with the Nazarene sacrifice being evil.
Yeah.
But I don't think she even knows that the Nazarene sacrifice is a thing. They've been portraying them as Church of the Icons.
Right.
They've been portraying themselves as a branch of the Church of the Icons. And she has, I think, accepted that the Church of the Icons takes in many different flavours of the faith and just tries to show how they all fit into the Nine Icons.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
So this is a slightly strange thing, where they, you know, from a culture where they haven't burnt bodies but insist on carrying them around forever. But if they need a pilot to fly them through space forever, then she's your man or woman.
So would this...
So I think that gets away with it.
Okay. I think...
Particularly,
it's a smidge tenuous, I would say, but...
Yeah. And what if they take other visitors? Because I thought it would be a lovely idea if the shuttle kind of has to descend through the hangar, to the hangar, through the scaffolding of the external cargo.
I love that idea,
And so I decided maybe the shuttle didn't have any windows except... in the cabin, but then,
except for,
like you,
for the
I
pilot.
Went. Except the pilot's one of the people. I think that might be the point where I thought, let's give this shuttle an AI so that, you know,
she doesn't have to pilot it.
Maybe she's never actually sat in the pilot seat.
No, maybe.
But
Cool. So presumably, though, this is a design of ship that lots of people around the horizon, if they saw it, would immediately recognise it as being something evil.
I'm not sure, because it's 100 years old. I think there may be, you know, well, it's, I think I've said it's about 300 years old, but it's at least 70 years since the Legion wiped the last of the Nazarene sacrifice vessels that they could find.
Right.
From the Black. So, you know, that's two or three generations. I mean, I'm sure there will be a dramatically appropriate moment where some non-player character kind of gets a glimpse of the ship and says, hold on, you guys are evil. Right now, I'm not making it a problem. And especially by the fact that that ship's out in space, miles away, yeah, in the dark, between the stars. Mm. And the ship that they actually interface with most normal people is the shuttle, which is a perfectly ordinary Mirren, yep, modern, brand new shuttle that might well look like it is the sort of thing that somebody from the Church of the Icons, yeah, would fly around, cool, in.
Cool. I just having a quick look at your picture that you drew, and it strikes me that you've got your rectangular structure where the bodies are. And on either side of it, on two sides of it, you've got like the engines. You wonder who gets the cheap seats that are hidden behind the engines. You know, you think if they were all saints, so then you'd think, hang on, I'm not going to be stuck down here next to a blooming exhaust from this engine for eternity.
Bear in mind, these are gravitic engines, so you know that's not actually burning. That's not like gas flame coming out. Although I will obviously admit that it's all about energy of some sort coming out, and energy could well be giving off some form of heat. I'm sure those aren't the best places to be.
But, so they're cooked.
yeah. But I think that within, you know, not only they're being irradiated by every sun they pass, they're being splattered by every micro particle that, I think that's part of the joy of leaving your body in space. I think they're all okay with that.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
But that sketch, you know, you can see that I'm not the best 3D modeler. I'm not at all a 3D modeler because that's not a 3D modeler. That was just getting in my own head. We'd talk some pictures, you know, that was a really interesting kind of group decision about what the ship should be. Yeah. Is first of all, they were looking at the Nazarene descriptions of the Nazarene ships, and they said, can we have like a, not Nazarene ships, so the Zelossian ships with their battle scenes painted on the outside. And they said, oh, can we have like actual bodies? Okay. No, don't be stupid. I mean, even if you're going to be the Nazarene sacrifice, you're not going to have actual bodies on your ship. And then when I read about external cargo, I thought,
why not?
Oh, but they can. Yeah.
Excellent. No, it's a great, really good. Excellent little bit of work there. Matt, really enjoyed that.
Cool. What are we going to talk about next week?
I don't know.
Now, we did promise not to talk about The Expanse when it came up in conversation earlier on, but there is actually something I'd like to bring from The Expanse to Coriolis. And I haven't quite worked out how to do it yet, but by the next episode, I will at least have a suggestion that we can discuss. And that is, The Expanse has a kind of slightly more complex system for getting information out of people. It's, you know, it's kind of based around the detective feeling of the Expanse books and TV series.
Okay.
So it's gone quite big on, cool, that. So you're, and that's one of the things that worked really well in the Expanse, and I've got an idea about how you might bring that to Coriolis. So let me correlate my thoughts.
Consider that your homework. Consider that your homework, Matt.
Okay.
Homework delivered.
Brilliant.
Cool.
Improving manipulation.
Excellent. And I'm sure we'll think of some other things as well to talk about before we reconvene for next time. But I think
other stuff will happen.
It will.
There'll be a Kickstarter about blooming Tales in the Flood that we need to talk about. Brilliant. Well, thank you everybody for listening to us today. From me, it's goodbye.
And it's goodbye for me. And may the icons bless your dead bodies. That didn't sound right, did it? No, I don't want my listeners to be dead.
Maybe we should say, and may your departed journey under the blessings of the icons.
That'll do. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye. We'll be right back. You have been listening to The Coriolis Effect, presented by Fiction Suit with the RPG Gods, with music by Stars on a Black Sea, used with permission of Free League Publishing. Imagery from NASA and the Hubble Space Telescope, brought to you by Wikimedia Commons. Typeface is Code by FontFabric.
Cut the wives out, right?
Yeah. We'll edit some of your wives out of that.
Not sure we will. Depends what. So what's the offer, Adam? What do we get if we edit out the wives comment?
We can talk some patron discounts, maybe.
Right. Okay.
We'll do that offline then, shall we? Yeah. Excellent.
Brilliant. Smashing. Yeah. I'm going to stop recording.
Brilliant.
Now.
Thanks very much, Adam.